Well, good morning. Better get this out. This might be handy at some point. Well, I appreciate you being in here this morning. There's a lot we're going to talk about over the next 45 minutes in regards to some areas about leadership. And when it comes to leadership, I think it's the most critical piece that's needed in the church today. I'm not opposed to preacher training. I think preacher training schools are wonderful. But if we don't correct the challenges that we're facing in leadership, there may not be the need for preacher training schools. In this country, there are 13,000 congregations of the Churches of Christ. Among those, about 65% do not have elders. The remaining 35% don't have enough. And the majority of them have two, which means they're one death away from having none. And in my experience of working with congregations over the last 10 years or so, I only know of really a handful of those congregations that actively have something in place to prepare the next generation to lead. Now, what we're going to be talking about during this particular time is this idea of vision. And I want to share with you, I've been reading a book here recently by Aubrey Malfers and Gordon Penfold, I think is his last name. And I came across a very interesting quote that I thought would be a great place for us to start. A great number of churches are characterized by an inward, self-serving focus, territorialism, bullies, power brokers, passivity, disillusionment, lack of a clearly defined purpose and vision, all accompanied by division and conflict. When I began to think about this statement, there was one particular thought that really stood out, and it was this one. A lack of a clearly defined purpose and vision. Now, it doesn't take long when we look at the church today to realize that there are a number of problems that have divided us as a whole. And this is just a few that you will see as we go through this particular material. I mean, people have divided over buildings and preachers and PowerPoint and schools of preaching and Christian universities and biblical versions, personalities, politics, chairs, pews. I mean, which one should we have? And we laugh, but it's reality. There are congregations that have divided over these and many other issues. And sometimes what happens is we begin to put ourselves in the place of the Lord in the book of Revelation and we remove people's candlesticks for them. You don't want to go over there. And don't get me wrong, you'll notice that none of these things are doctrinal in nature. We're not talking about doctrinal things here. We're talking about opinions. And which school did you go to? And it has divided us as a nation of people, and it has certainly divided us as the church. And I think it's because we don't have a vision. Now, when I talk about vision, there is a lot that we're going to be focused on today, but this statement is one that I thought very interesting. A man without a vision is a man without a future, and a man without a future will always return to his past. I don't know how many times I've heard over the years, you know, back in the 1950s and the 1960s, and don't misunderstand me, there were some good things that happened in the 50s and 60s. But that was a different culture. And we're not living in that culture anymore. And as long as we try to do things the way that they were done in the 50s and 60s, in the 21st century, we're going to continue to see what we're seeing today. And that is a decline, because we're not living in the same culture. I heard it expressed one time, when you look at the book of Acts, you find that in Acts chapter 2, there is a certain culture. When Peter preached on the day of Pentecost, in that passage of text where we find Peter's sermon, he used almost 50% of his lesson was book, chapter, and verse. I mean, he was quoting the Old Testament. When you get to Acts chapter 17, Paul was preaching in a completely different culture, and in his entire sermon, he didn't use one passage from the Old Testament. We are not living in the same culture. Now, please do not misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not saying that we don't preach the Bible. I'm not saying that we don't use book, chapter, and verse. What I'm saying is we can apply the same methodology that we've used 50 years ago to the culture that we live in today, because it's not the same. Our vision has to be different. Now, here's the next quote that to me is the most damaging. Chris Vallotton made the statement that if our memories are greater than our dreams, we're already dying. If all we're going to do is try to relive and focus on the days that have gone by, the past, then we're already dying. What is our vision and where are we headed as the church in the 21st century? So I want to share with you some information that hopefully will be very significant in regards to our subject. Vision is about faith and future. Now, of course, you can see that it describes who and what we want to be or become, but I want us to focus for just a moment about one particular biblical character that we know a great deal about, and that is a man by the name of Abraham. When we look at the life of Abraham, there is a great deal that we learn about him specifically, and first and foremost, about his faith. He was a man of great faith, the father of faith, as we would identify him. What's interesting to me is when you read about Abraham's faith and the progression of his faith, it's very fascinating to me to really focus in on one particular area, and that was faith in something that he could not see. And that's the way vision works. We're able to see something, but not through a physical eye, but through an eye of faith. For Abraham, when you look at the book of Hebrews, in Hebrews chapter 11, I really encourage you to study that chapter and just highlight all of the things that are found in that chapter that involve what is seen and what is not seen. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, but it is the conviction of things not seen. By faith, we understand that the worlds were prepared by the Word of God so that what is visible was not made out of things which are seen, or that which is seen was not made out of things which are visible. Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death. By faith, Noah, warned by God about things not yet seen, prepared an ark for the salvation of his household. And then, of course, one of my favorites is the parents of Moses. When they saw that he was a beautiful child. Now, they weren't looking at him and seeing those locks of hair flowing from his head saying, "That is a beautiful baby." Not in a chapter on faith and not on a chapter that's talking about things that are seen and not seen. They saw something through faith in this child that was about his future. And of course, they passed that on because Moses fled Egypt not fearing the wrath of the king, because he was able to see him who is unseen. Now, in between all of this, in Hebrews chapter 11, we have this section that we read about Abraham. And in that text, it tells us, by faith, Abraham went out to a land not knowing where he was going. There's a lot that we don't understand about the future. And we've often used that statement that I don't know what the future holds, but I know the one who holds the future. If we could just embrace that thought for a moment when we think about vision, that maybe vision really is about going to a place that we really don't know where we're going. We just know who we want to be and who we want to become. And when we think about the future, I guess one of my favorite passages in regards to Abraham comes in Genesis chapter 13. Interesting text, because there's a conflict that has arisen between the herdsman of Abraham and the herdsman of Lot, his nephew. And so in this conflict that's taken place, Abraham, because they become so productive and so rich, he tells Lot, "You look out, you go wherever you want to go, and I'm going to go the other direction." And so Lot looks out and he sees Sodom and Gomorrah, and he sees it's a beautiful and productive land, so he decides to go there. And what I love about this text is that it's not until Lot leaves that God shows up. And when God shows up in verses 14 and 15, he tells Abraham, lift up your eyes and look. Northward, southward, eastward, westward, all that your eyes behold, I will give to you and to your descendants forever. Abraham never saw the fulfillment of that promise. He never did. Because it wouldn't happen for about 430 years before God would fulfill that promise that he made to him. And ultimately, it was connected to an earlier promise in chapter 12 that through his seed, all the families of the earth would be blessed, which would not be fulfilled until the coming of Christ. So when we look about faith and future, the vision that God had for Abraham and the direction that he was going was something that he would never see, but he welcomed from a distance, the writer of the book of Hebrews tells us. And when I look at that text in Genesis chapter 13, there are three components that I think really become very foundational for us when we think about vision. First of all, we're going to have to lift up our eyes and look. It amazes me sometimes what people don't want to see. Now, maybe they just cover their eyes because they don't want to see it. Or maybe they wear blinders. I think more importantly for us today is the tendency that we have to put on blinders. We only know to look in one specific direction. And if you come back to the session next hour, we're going to talk about spirituality types and tie more of that together. But we tend to only look in one specific direction. And God says, lift up your eyes and look. Do you remember the similar phrase that Jesus used in John chapter 4? When the disciples were looking at this multitude of people, the Samaritans who were coming, and Jesus says, you say there are yet 4 months until the harvest, and I say, lift up your eyes and look. The fields are white unto harvest. Here's this multitude of people that they certainly would never have dreamed would have accepted Jesus. And he says, your vision has to be different than what you can see with your physical eye. So we need to lift up our eyes and look. I quit going to preacher's luncheons, not because I don't like the preachers, it's because I got tired of the content. Because it seemed that all we were talking about every time was the decline of congregations and the fact that people don't want to hear the truth. And I disagree. I don't think it's that people don't want to hear the truth. I think it's the way we package it. It's our methodology that's driving people away. So we're going to have to find a way to reach people and have the kind of vision that knows how to package that so that people will understand it, because it's a different culture. We live in a culture that's very skeptical of anything that's related to divine. Scripture being inspired. And we're out here trying to quote book, chapter, and verse to a people that don't believe that the Bible is from God. Why would they listen? So we're going to have to reshape our thinking and our vision about how we approach them. That's what Paul did in Acts chapter 17, and we're going to have to do it as well. But not only did he say, lift up your eyes and look, wasn't it interesting that he told him to look in every direction? Have you ever thought about looking in every single direction? Northward, southward, eastward, westward. And why did he tell him to look in every direction? I tend to think that to miss looking in a certain direction is to miss possessing what God had promised. And sometimes we miss something because we're not looking in every direction. We're only looking in one. Now there's a little piece that I left out of that text in verses 14 and 15 that to me is the most important piece when it comes to the idea of our vision. Because when he told Abraham to lift up his eyes and look, he says, from the place where you stand. That phrase, to me, is the most significant piece. And the reason is because far too often we tend to only see what we think will be fruitful and productive somewhere else. Over the last 10 years of my life, I've traveled to many different countries and I've seen a lot of people go on a lot of different mission trips. And it's amazing to me how much money, and please don't misunderstand me, we live in a world that needs Jesus. Billions of people that need Jesus. But what fascinates me is that we'll spend thousands upon thousands of dollars to travel all over the world to take the gospel, and we won't walk across the street. Amen. Don't our neighbors need Jesus? I'm not saying don't go on short-term mission trips. I'm saying go across the street. It's a lot cheaper, and they need Him just as much. But we've got to have a vision for that. Now, as we think about this idea of faith and future, and this idea of who and what we want to be or what we want to become, and it comes to vision, we need to ask some questions. What are our hopes and dreams? What is it that we really hope for? What is it that we're really dreaming of for the future? And then what problem are we solving for the greater good? And who or what are we inspiring to change? I want you to keep those questions in mind as we look at some ideas about vision over the next few moments. But I want to share with you some reasons why vision is so important for you. I have started really focusing most of my work in the SALT ministry, working with elderships, working with congregations, and creating a vision. Without a vision statement for the congregation, it's very difficult. Because what we end up doing without a vision is we just do a bunch of stuff. And the reason we do that stuff is because that's what we've always done. I mean, why do we have a VBS? Because we've always had a VBS. Why do we have a gospel meeting in the spring and in the fall that nobody attends? Half the congregation doesn't come. And why do we have that? Well, because we've always had a VBS. And I'm not saying those events aren't good. I'm not saying that they're not useful and that we shouldn't do them. My question is, why are we doing them? When we have a vision, it informs our decision-making process. And this has been one of the most insightful things for congregations that has excited me to see them getting that. Because now when people come in and say, we should do this, and you can say, does it help us achieve our vision? If it doesn't help us achieve our vision, then the answer is no. We're not doing that. See how simple that was? It's not about, well, they really want to do this. Well, I'm glad they really want to do it, but it's not going to help us achieve where we are going and who we want to be. And if it does help us achieve our vision, then the answer is yes. Let's do that and let's figure out how to make it happen. So first and foremost, vision helps us make decisions. Number two, it motivates the actions of our life and church. Now, this is both an individual and a collective thing. From an individual perspective, do we know who we want to be, who we want to become? We ask our kids that when they're real young. What do you want to be when you grow up? We're asking a five-year-old to have a vision for the future. And then when we become an adult, we have no idea where we're going. I mean, well, I got married and I got kids and I've got grandkids. But who do you want to be? I mean, what is your vision for the future? What do you want to fulfill with your life? I don't know. We just tend to exist. And what's happened, and this is so sad to me, we tend to attend church simply because that's what we do. And that's what we do between 9:30 and 11:30 every Sunday morning. And it really isn't driven. There's not the motivation that drives us to do that because we don't have any vision. I've asked congregations, and I'm going to be a little transparent here because it's kind of a bit of a struggle for me, is Sunday night worship. Now, I'm going to preface this by saying, I'm not in favor of meeting less. I'm in favor of meeting more. My question is, do we know why we meet on Sunday night? When we can't answer that question, this millennial generation, the next generation, the X generation, the Y generation, the Z generation, I mean, they're asking that question because they want to know, why are we doing this? And if we can't answer that with anything other than that's the way we've always done it, they're not buying that. Now, again, I'm not saying we meet less. I'm saying, what is it that motivates our actions as a body of people as to why we're meeting? And have we communicated that to this next generation? Vision. It motivates. And then it creates meaning. When our vision is in place and we are communicating that vision to the congregation, they understand the why. And when they understand that, they're going to get behind it. And isn't that what we want? That we want people to be behind what we're doing and why we are doing it? Well, it creates that meaning for us. I would really recommend a book for you called Start With Why by Simon Sinek. It is an incredible book that really drives home. It's a corporate book because it talks about companies that exist that are really the big companies like Apple and PC and Macintosh or Microsoft, all those big companies like that. It's not just about what they do or how they do it. They understand why they do it. And I see this in the church. We understand what to do. And we understand how to do it. But the question is, do we know why we do that? And have we communicated that? So it creates meaning. And then number four is that it challenges us to do something great. That's why we want a vision. That's why we need a vision for the church, because it will challenge us to do something great. I always like to tell the story about you never know if something's really true that's said in history or not. And of course, you always hear that thing about, well, everything on the internet is true because Abraham Lincoln said that. Well, I don't know if this story is true about Abraham Lincoln or not, but I like to tell it because it's so powerful. We do know that he was a religious man, and we know that he said a lot of great things about the Bible because we have that recorded in history for us. But the story is told, whether true or not, but the story is told that he went and he attended a worship service one time, and he took one of his political aides with him, and they kind of went in the side door. As the president, you might imagine, during the time, you try to avoid all of the publicity and all the hubbub that goes with that. And so after the sermon was over, they exited out the side door, and the aide was asking him, "Did you like the sermon?" And he said, "It wasn't a great sermon." And the aide said, "How can you say that?" And he said, "Because he didn't challenge me to do something great." That's what a vision does for us. It challenges us to do something great with God's help, not something that we can do on our own. If it's what we're doing on our own, then we don't need God. And that kind of defeats the whole purpose, doesn't it? It's about doing something great with God's help. So let me share with you a few things that I share when I talk about the idea of vision, and that begins with discovering the why. I met with a congregation not too long ago, I won't say where, but they had a building that would seat about 300 or so people. Their attendance on Sunday was about 16. Their core group was 12. They had two elders. They wanted to meet, wanted to talk about what they could do. And so the question I asked them was this: why would someone choose to attend and be a part of the congregation here? Now, apart from the physical appearance of the building, I mean, the building had, you know how carpet, when it stretches, kind of wrinkles up? And it had stains all over it. It was red. They had a darkened auditorium. Everything was paneling. It smelt musty. I mean, when you walked in, the smell of the building was kind of like old. And so I just asked him. I didn't say any of that stuff. I just asked him. I said, why would someone choose to attend here? Why would they come here to be a part of this congregation? And it took them a while. Finally, one of the guys said, well, we're biblically sound. I said, and that's great. You should be, but nobody else knows that. Everybody in this community thinks all religious people are sound. So why would they choose to come here? And then he said, well, I know everybody says this, but we really are friendly. I'm thinking, you have 12 people and they don't sit together in an auditorium that will seat 300. You're telling me you're friendly. I'm like, but again, Nobody knows that. See, we're always so inwardly focused on what's going on inside the building that we forget to ask this question. Why would somebody choose to come and attend and be a part of the congregation where you're at? If they don't know anything but what they can see from the externals of the building, there's a good chance they will never come. Why? That's a tough question. I remember our kids asking that a lot growing up. We'd give them a response and they'd say, why? You'd tell them another response, I'd say, but why? You see, they want to know why, and I'm telling you, we're living in a culture that's asking why. And we've got to be able to provide them with an answer. And if we don't, then chances are we're going to miss out on something great. Then we need to consider and evaluate two thoughts. The first thought is, do we see ourselves correctly? When it comes to vision, how do we see ourselves? If we don't know who we are, then it becomes very difficult to know who we want to become. And that's our vision. And so when we think about this idea of do we see ourselves correctly, I don't remember exactly when it was, but it's been about 8 years ago or so. I saw this little video clip of a gentleman named Henry Nouwen. I don't know if anybody knows that name or not, but he was talking about that in this time continuum between the point in which we're born and the point in which we die, that regardless of where that is for us, because when you look around this room, some of us started earlier, some of us started later, some of us will die earlier and some of us will die later, and we don't know when that is. But in between those two points, we're striving to answer this question, who am I? Who am I? Now, what's challenging is that the world in which we live in answers it in one of three ways. I am what I do. And so we strive to do good. We strive to have success, because when we do good and we have success in life, it makes us feel good about who we are. Secondly is, I am what others say about me. And in some ways, as he pointed out, this one is more important than the others to us, because we want other people to speak well about us. When they speak well about us, we feel like we fit in. We belong. There's a sense of acceptance. And so a lot of what we do is because we want people to speak well about us. And then the third is I am what I have. I have good health. I have a good family. I have material things. And so when all of that's in place, we feel good about who we are. Sadly, it's a lie. It's all a lie. Because what happens if that's the way we're striving to live between these two points? Our life becomes this just huge zigzag of trying to stay above the line. And when we experience failure, or when people don't speak well of us, or we don't have good health, or we don't have things, then we get in this place of depression, deep darkness. We're discouraged. And all the while we fall and prey to this trap of believing a lie, because that's not who we are. Do you remember when Jesus was led into the wilderness to be tempted by Satan there in Matthew chapter 4? And isn't it kind of interesting the similarities that exist with the temptations with those three thoughts? If you're the Son of God, command these stones to be turned to bread. Do something. And then he took him up to the pinnacle of the temple and said, if you're the Son of God, cast yourself down. I mean, he even quotes Scripture. God will not allow you to bear your foot against a stone, but will send his angels to bear you up. But have you ever thought about why the pinnacle of the temple? Wasn't that where everybody was? I mean, think about what people will say if that happens. And then he showed him all the kingdoms of the earth, and he said, all of these things I will give to you. Look at what you will have if you will fall down and worship me. Now, I know that we all know that Jesus responded every single time by saying, it is written. It is written. But really what Jesus was saying to Satan is, it's a lie, Satan. That's not who I am. Do you remember what happened just right before? I mean, right at the end of chapter 3, before he was led into the wilderness, what happened? His baptism. And a voice out of heaven said, "This is my beloved Son." I mean, Jesus knew who he was. And he never lost sight of that, no matter what happened, no matter what he did, no matter what people said about him, and no matter what he had. Jesus always held on to the truth that he was the beloved Son of God. And I find it beautiful to recognize that that's how Paul describes us as Christians, as those who are holy and beloved. We are the beloved children of God. And somehow and in some way, if we could ever help people see that, that this is who we are. I tell you, I'm so tired of hearing people say, "We're sinners." We're not sinners. That's who we once were. But we've been washed. We've been sanctified. We're not sinners anymore. We're the beloved of God. We need to change our terminology. I saw some post on Facebook that some person was making this big statement about being this horrible, wretched sinner. And I'm like, we got to stop that. Now, I'm not saying we don't ever sin, but that doesn't characterize who we are if we're walking in the light. If we're walking in the light, we have the continual cleansing blood of Jesus, and we are the beloved of our Father. That's who we are. It's who I am. And if we could help people see that that's who we are, that that's who we need to see ourselves as, then maybe it would change our vision. But secondly, we also have to consider, do we see our God correctly? You know, sometimes I think that's the biggest problem, is we don't see God correctly. We tend to view God as being somewhere out there, and that He's just left us down here on this earth to kind of make it on our own and figure it out. And I think sometimes that what happens is that we tend to exclude God, thinking that God's not going to do something because we've convinced ourselves that we can't do it because we don't see ourselves correctly. And that hinders the way that we see our God. There are a lot of passages that we could turn to. My favorite, and my wife tells me to quit saying that about passages of Scripture because they're all kind of my favorite, but Ephesians 3:20, is that not a powerful verse? "Now to Him who is able to do far more abundantly beyond all that we ask or think, according to the power that works within us." There's our two thoughts in the one verse. Do we see ourselves correctly, and the power that works within us, and do we see our God correctly? I've often asked the question. I saw it actually for the first time on one of those little signs, you know, on beside the road next to, I don't even remember what religious group it was. It was there in Denver somewhere. And I'm just driving down the road and there's this sign and it asked this question. What would you do if you knew you could not fail? Isn't that an interesting question? What would you do if you knew you could not fail? Because the bottom line is we can't. The only time we fail is if we quit. We don't fail. Our God made sure that we wouldn't fail because He sent His Son to die for us and raised Him from the dead. We can't fail because the whole book of Revelation is about we win. There is no failure here. Our God, if we know who He is, then is there anything we cannot achieve? There's an old Chinese proverb that says, "Limitations are the boundaries that we place in our own minds." And that's really true. As long as we convince ourselves that we can't do something, then it's going to be difficult for us to see our God correctly and to realize that He not only can, but He will do it. Whether through us, as Wesley said this morning, or through someone else, He's going to do it. When we think about a vision, we need to evaluate those two thoughts. We also need to know what success looks like. You know, I just sat in Wayne's class. He was talking about small churches and what small churches can do to think about growth and those kind of things. And I'm of that mindset. He and I have talked a great deal about this small church concept and how much more effective it is in so many ways. But I want you to think about, how do we determine success? What does success look like? And as he pointed out, our tendency is to always think in numbers. It's how many baptisms. We even send money, support, missionaries to areas that we think are going to produce more baptisms. I have done a lot of work with the school and Christians in Cambodia, and I'm telling you, they don't view success on that basis. And it frustrates them that people will not get involved or support that work as much because they don't see the numbers of baptisms. When you think about a vision for the church today, this is not about numbers. Let me tell you what vision is about. It's about lives that are changed. Because if people's lives are not changed, we can have 150,000 people in a coliseum. But if they leave that coliseum and their lives are no different, if they're not better fathers and better mothers and better husbands and better wives and better employees, if they're not better at living their life here as God intended for them, then the chances are that we have not really been successful. We need to know what success looks like. And then we need to keep it simple. Our vision, I really encourage congregations and work with them to try to make their vision statement in one sentence. Something that's simple, something that can be remembered, and something that they will keep before the congregation everywhere. I know of a congregation that they wrote 1,000 words. The idea was, is a picture is worth 1,000 words. So they made a vision statement that's 1,000 words. Guess who remembers it? Nobody. And don't get me wrong, I think that was really kind of outlining the mission of what they wanted to accomplish. But make the vision statement simple so that people will remember it and that they will be able to share that with others. Because if they can remember it, then chances are they are going to buy in to achieving it. And then develop a mission statement that's going to help you see what to do. Also, it needs to be concrete. So I'll give you an example. Is this a good vision statement? To be a great church? No. And the reason is because when you think about this particular statement, the problem is, how do you define great? If you have to get everybody has their own definition, or if you have to go to people and have them get a dictionary to look up the definition of what you mean by this particular term, change it. A vision statement needs to be concrete, not abstract, not something that's going to mean something to one person that means something different to somebody else, but something that's simple that everybody can understand and that they can follow. And then it needs to be challenging, energizing, and meaningful. It needs to drive everything that the congregation is involved in and that they're a part of. So those are just a few of the areas that I like to talk about in regards to vision. And of course, I really spend a lot of time with congregations, sometimes six or seven hours just to lay the groundwork to help them start going through the process. But I encourage you that whatever congregation you're with, that you need to work with your leaders in some way and somehow to have a vision for that congregation. And I've been asked, well, won't they basically all be the same? And I'm like, no. It's fascinating to me that when people start answering the question, why would somebody want to be a part of this congregation, that it really influences the direction of how they develop their vision. Because depending upon the answers to that question, it's interesting to find the threads that help them see who they need to be as they move into the future, who they want to become and who they want to be known as when it comes to the church. So spend the time to go through that process, and you'll be surprised how that works. I've always thought this was an interesting statement. What you see is what you get. And if you can't see it, then chances are you'll never get it. And that's true physically, literally, and it's true spiritually. What do we see? When you think about your family, what do you see? When you think about the people who sit on the pew next to you every Sunday morning, what do you see? When you go to Walmart, or you go to the bank, or you go to the grocery store, or you go to some mall and you see thousands of people walking by you every day, what do you see? I've often asked myself that, sitting in an airport. And as I sat there looking at the myriads of people walking by and wondering, do they even know the name above all names? What do we see? Maybe if we would just back up and think for a moment, it might change our concept about what we see. Most of this presentation, you've kind of seen the fog. This pair of glasses represents a lot. When you think about everything around them, it's just kind of distorted. It's fuzzy. It's not clear. It'd be hard to want to step out into that region with that kind of vision, wouldn't it? But through those glasses, everything becomes perfectly clear. God has given us some pretty good lenses to put on and look through. And sometimes we just need to look. Lift up your eyes and look from the place where you stand. Every direction. Everything that your eyes behold, I will give to you and to your descendants forever. Vision. I know that we're kind of at the end of the class period, but if you have a question, I would love to do my best to defer that to John Arvin. And John, who's had my class, knows all about that. It's good to see you, John. Can't wait to hug you. Now, we'll put this plug in. If you would like to have me come, I'd love to sit down with your congregation. Sunset has made it possible for me to do this at no cost to you. And so I would love to come and sit down with you, stop by the table out there, pick up a business card. I'd love to sit down and work with you, your congregation, leaders, whatever it is. There's a lot more than just creating vision for the congregation, but the whole aspect of working to prepare for the next generation and what we can do to put in place a plan that will help them. At the website, salt.sunset.bible, you will find 80 lessons that are currently online that you can download for free. And you can use those to start a class. They're all designed for teaching an adult Bible class in areas of leadership and leadership development. And so you can start there and just go through the whole list, or I can come and work with you on how to use those. They're very dialogue-oriented, and so I'll encourage you to go there and use them. There are all kinds of various lessons. Even this material on creating vision is on there. Strategic planning is on there. Character development, biblical principles about leadership, why men do not lead. There are about five lessons, and we're adding to the material all the time. And so salt.sunset.bible, and you'll find those lessons there that you can download and use if you want them.